Case this morning is United States against Terry. Counsel for appellant.
May it please the court. Lieutenant Colonel Frank Levy and along with Lieutenant Colonel Mark Strickland, we represent the appellant in this case, Staff Sergeant Keith M. Terry. Requested to be allowed to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
That's granted.
Thank you, sir. We have two issues in this case, both of which require that this court set aside the findings and remand the case back for a new hearing. The military judge improperly denied the challenge for cause for two members and allowed them to remain on the panel, thereby prejudicing appellant for his right to a fair trial. The second issue is the judge's erroneous issuing of a constructive force instruction to the members based on Staff Sergeant Terry's status as an ultrasound technician. I'd like to turn first to the issue related to the challenge for cause, and then I'll address the issue of the constructive force argument second. The judge allowed, over defense objection on the grounds of bias, Captain Alvarez and Major Houth to remain on the panel in spite of their personal connection and involvement with the crime of rape. This court, as recently as the Leonard case, has enjoined military judges to follow a liberal grant mandate in dealing with implied bias. In this case, the military judge only considered the actual bias of the two members in question. It's clear from the record that she focused solely on their demeanor and the statements that they gave in response to voir dire. She looked at whether they stated that they could render a fair and impartial decision, notwithstanding their personal involvement with the crime of rape. She never got to the issue of implied bias. And as this court in the Downing case made clear, there needs to be something in a record that shows that the military judge applied the right law and that at least something be on the record in terms of analysis and application. Now,
there needs to be something in the record if we're going to afford deference to the judge, or there needs to be something in the record, period, you win if there isn't.
Your Honor, Downing said that there needs to be something in the record in order for this court to give whatever deference is due in an implied bias case, which the standard has been set rather low in terms of deference or implied bias. But the court made it clear that when the record's silent, no deference should be given. And that's what we have here. We have a record that is silent on the implied bias of these two members. Now, looking at this issue, we know it's an objective standard for implied bias. And the question becomes, to the objective observer, would the situation with both Captain Alvarez and Major Houth be, what the court uses the language in the Dalton case, of asking them too much, asking too much of the system? Our position is that it would be. Captain Alvarez had a girlfriend that he dated for a number of years, on and off through college, who was raped when she was visiting relatives in the Dominican Republic. She became pregnant, actually had the baby, and named the child after him. And in his response to voir dire, he said that they were heading towards marriage, in his mind at least, and that this was a very significant relationship. I want to draw the court's attention to the record at page 142. In response to a question from trial counsel on voir dire, Captain Alvarez actually states, in response to the question about whether a record or a report was ever made about the rape down in the Dominican Republic, he said, "There's no law down there. Whoever has the money makes the law, and they had the money. Now, reading that, it certainly is a clear indication that this experience that Captain Alvarez had was a significant personal experience that has affected him and continues to affect him. He had his life changed because of this. And we see a akin to the Moss case, in which the member's nephew died because of his mother's cocaine use. And the court found that the denial for implied bias was improper, and that because the member had been personally affected by the drug use of his nephew's mother, that in itself, that rose to the level of implied bias.
Is the test personal effect? Aren't all persons affected by being victims of crime or knowing someone? It sounds like a per se test that you're putting on the table.
Your Honor, we're not suggesting a per se test. It's totality of the circumstances. But
so what puts this circumstance over the top in terms of moving beyond the per se victim effect argument to implied bias in this case?
The responses to voir dire that got into the personal effect that all this had on Captain Alvarez.
And if you're looking at the totality of the circumstances, what is the best argument that this was not implied bias, and what is your response to that?
The best argument that it was not implied bias?
Right.
Probably the time that it passed.
Okay, and then what is your response to that? We're looking at 7 years.
Right. The response to that is but reading his responses, it's not the time that has passed that has changed anything in his perception of what happened. It's simply that he got married to another woman, and out of respect for her, he does not speak to his old girlfriends. On the record, that is what he explained as to why he's not in contact with her anymore. If we certainly can't glean from that what would happen if he hadn't been married now, but this is not a situation where 20 years ago something happened and it's long forgotten. And we recognize that in dealing with implied bias, there are situations where it becomes so remote in time that even for somebody who was personally victimized through a robbery, that makes sense. Now, granted, every offense is different. Certainly, when you get into the violent crimes like rape or murder, I think looking at totality of the circumstances, then time may be different for each offense and for each person. The judge, military judge, should have looked at that. And she should have looked at that also for Major Howth. Now, granted, he did not know his wife when she was sexually abused and raped by her stepfather. But it still happened, and what we're left with, because of the judge's denial of the challenge for cause, we're left with the two senior members of this panel both having a personal experience related to the crime of rape. So from an objective standard, is that the type of panel that the military justice system should seek? No, it's not.
Counsel, with respect to Major Howth, in this case it appears that, and please supply the information if I've misread the record, that with respect to the incident between his wife and her stepfather, we don't know whether it was rape or some other form of sexual contact, whether it was a one-time incident or multiplied, whether it caused her any long-term psychological harm, or whether it had any effect on the marriage. Is that Is that how, where the record leaves us at this point?
I think that's a fair characterization, although I do recall some discussion, at least on the part of the military judge, in denying the challenge for cause, saying that the, you know, the rape, or it was, Major Huff was a little ambiguous about the facts of what happened, and I think the record reflects that he was just trying to protect his wife's privacy.
Who bears the burden at this point? Who at trial, but especially now on appeal, of when we're dealing with implied bias. If we're dealing with implied bias, and the question is looking at the record, and I'm only talking about Major Howe at this point, looking at the record, reasonably informed person looking at this record, why wouldn't they say, I don't know what went on there, and I have no idea whether it affected the wife, much less the marriage. So why should we assume that this person wasn't qualified to sit?
Well, I think there's two responses to that. The first one is that at trial, the burden would be on the defense to raise the issue of bias, which they did. Whether or not the judge in her discretion is going to grant it or not, it's a fair question. The defense has to establish some reason why it should be granted. So the burden is on the defense at that point. But what we're talking about here, to take a step back, is the judge's failure to even address the issue of implied bias. The defense raised the issue of bias in challenging these two members. The military judge never got to implied bias. Well, she focused solely on actual bias.
But per the earlier discussion, oral argument, does that get the defense any further than a backing away from deference that might otherwise be given to the military judge? That is, if the judge hasn't said anything, then we're looking at the cold record in the case with little, if any, deference to the judge's decision. And here, the record doesn't indicate anything more than something happened. And if we were to, again, just focusing on Howe, determine that he was disqualified, why doesn't that, in effect, establish a per se rule of disqualification that any time a potential member has a spouse who was the victim of any act of sexual misconduct, no matter how slight in the past, no matter how far in the past, that member can't sit. I'm not sure I can see Howe as establishing anything other than that rule. Even if we didn't say per se rule, I don't know how anyone else coming here any judge applying the case in the field would say, well, somebody said the magic word, sexual abuse, that member's out of here.
There's no question that when you look at Major Howe, his situation does not jump out at you nearly the way that Captain Algebras does.
And don't we look at each one of these as a discrete matter? Unless there's some connection in the record or in the judge's thinking, aren't we supposed to look at each one of these separately?
For the question of whether the member should have the denial at the time of the trial, each member is going to be looked at individually. Looking at the totality of the circumstances for this panel, the question that the military judge should have been asking after looking at this individually for both Captain Alvarez and Major Howe was, we've got a trial here that is going to be extremely closely contested on the facts. Is it worth leaving a member on the panel, the senior member on the panel, who has some connection at all for this. Now, had she engaged in an implied bias analysis and then said, I don't find there to be implied bias here, and here's why, we'd have something to look at and to say, yeah, okay, at the time of trial, she made
those decisions. What could the judge possibly have said under the defense theory of this case that would have required us to give deference to the point that that we would sustain the judge's ruling?
That,
I'm not saying that from my perspective here, but from the perspective of the defense, what possibly could a defense, could a judge say in these circumstances to take it away from implied bias?
For Major Health?
For Major Health.
The fact that his wife was a victim of sexual assault, rape, call it what you will, from her, by her stepfather. It was never reported, it was never brought to trial, there was no final outcome of it. It simply was left there. Had she made, looked at that fact and said, I am not comfortable having someone with that set of facts serving on my panel, I'm going to find there to be implied bias, we'd have something. I'm not saying that she would have made that decision, but there is enough in the record to suggest that she
made
could
that
have.
If she had made that decision, we wouldn't be here, would we?
No, we wouldn't.
The government can't appeal that.
Exactly.
And so my question to you is, unless you're arguing for a per se rule, how do you take a situation like House, do an implied bias analysis at the trial level, and conclude that the member can sit?
If a military judge is properly applying the liberal grant mandate that this court has made clear is the standard that should be used, a military judge may well say, it's a close one here. I'm going to err on the side of caution and grant the denial, because the Court of Appeals for Armed Forces has made it clear to me, a military judge, that I should be liberal in my granting of these challenges. And there's enough here that causes me a little bit of discomfort, I'm going to grant it. That's the standard, at least as we read liberal grant mandate, that should be applied. And the problem we have here, Your Honor, is that we don't know anything about the military judge's thinking in terms of implied bias for either Major Health or Kevin Alvarez. If there are no further questions on the issue of the challenge for cause, I would like to turn to the constructive force argument. Thank you, Your Honor. The military judge improperly instructed the members that they could find a lack of consent on the part of Airman First Class S due solely to Staff Sergeant Terry's position as an ultrasound technician. That's an improper application of the law of constructive force, and it directly resulted in Staff Sergeant Terry's conviction. We know that constructive force is a situation when the victim is placed in fear for her life or bodily injury. Some of the cases that talks about grave bodily injury, some of it talks about bodily injury. I don't think it matters in this case. And that there be a belief that the resistance would be futile. Or there are other times where mental incapacity and the like that are inapplicable in this case. We'd focus the court's attention to the record at page 383 and 385. The military judge, and it's where she gave her instruction to the members, the military judge went through the proper explanation of the elements of the crime of rape, explained consent and force and so forth. And she explained what constructive force is. She then went a step further, and here's where she committed her error. She stated that there is evidence which, if believed, indicates that the accused used or abused his position as an ultrasound technician in order to coerce or force
Airman First Class S, to have sexual intercourse. And then she drew the members' attention to testimony that the accused worked as an ultrasound technician in the clinic. And then she said, you may consider this evidence in deciding whether she had a reasonable belief that death or great bodily harm would be inflicted upon her and that resistance would be futile. Now, even if you accept that in the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals focused on the fact that Sessors and Terry had conducted a completely professional ultrasound internal ultrasound examination the day before, on that Friday. And they focused on that creation of trust as a way of, to use the words of the court, procuring her cooperation for the study. The problem is, that doesn't have anything to do with whether or not, at the time of intercourse, Staff Sergeant Terry was exerting constructive force on Airman First Class S. Reading through the record, you get the sense of this escalating environment of sexual intimacy or charge, whatever you want to call it. You know, initially she comes in and he's doing the test on her arms. And then he moves up to her thighs, and then he asks her to remove her panties and so forth. At each step, she could have said, stop. No, what are you doing? This isn't what I came here for. She didn't. So if there is constructive force present, it would have to be at the time that the intercourse occurred, or leading right up to it. Not the Friday, not what got her to come for the study. That's a misplaced.
What's the measure of evidence in order to issue the instruction?
But there has to be some indication.
Some evidence?
Right.
And here, so you're saying there is no some evidence that should have prompted the military judge to give the instruction?
Well, the evidence that the military judge made clear on the record that she was, what triggered her issuing the instruction was his status as an ultrasound technician.
The status as the ultrasound technician, or all that was encompassed in that?
Well,
accused used or abused his position as an ultrasound technician. Right?
Right, but that's...
Does that not convey as well the surroundings and circumstances of the crime?
It discusses why she came on Saturday. It doesn't get into what happened when he asked her to remove her...
It's not fair inference that his accusing or abusing his position as an ultrasound is what put them in a remote corner of this hospital?
That's focusing on the study.
Let me restate it a different way. Would their presence in this ultrasound room, in the surrounding circumstances of that, amount to some evidence?
We don't.
Putting aside whether that's encompassed within the instruction.
Not of constructive force. But there's no question he is an ultrasound technician, and that was why she was there. But we're talking about the element of rape.
Would whispering in someone's ear, don't scream, could that amount to constructive force?
If there was evidence to suggest that she was in fear for her life or great bodily harm or resistance would be futile. There's no evidence to that at all.
That could not amount to some evidence that one would be in fear of great bodily harm, whispering in someone's ear, don't scream, while in a remote corner of a building?
It would be evidence of actual force if he was actually preventing her from leaving. But there's no evidence of any of that in the record. He
you know, at every step.
Wait,
she
there is evidence of that. Is that your...
Of constructive force?
No, that he says don't scream.
Yes, there's, yes.
Okay.
He said don't scream. Our position is that that could be considered a variety of different ways, and had the judge not...
But the issue here is whether it could be considered as some evidence.
Your Honor, I am out of time. May I continue
to answer the question?
It is some evidence of force. We do not accept that it is some evidence of constructive force.
Where's the force?
When he had...
I'm asking only about don't scream in a remote corner of a building.
He was laying... He had his laying...
I'm only asking about don't scream in a remote corner of a building. Let's take a hypothetical so you don't have to make any concessions. We're in the middle of the woods, thousands of miles away from anywhere, and the person says, don't scream. Is there some evidence of constructive force?
If there was a connection to don't scream, I'm not going to let you leave here. That's not a fair reading of the evidence, and had the judge not issued the constructive force instruction, the members would have looked solely at when he had his hands on her shoulders and grabbed her breast, was that, and said, don't scream, was that the force necessary to keep her there? Our position is it would be insufficient.
Does it matter, or should it matter with your error, that the mistake of fact instruction was also given?
No, we believe that by giving that constructive force argument the way she did, there was a suggestion to the members that his status as an ultrasound was the same as the drill instructor trainee relationship, and that status alone was enough.
Counsel, in response to Judge Baker's questions, you indicated that there was some evidence of force, but not constructive force. If that was the case, then why don't we just consider that the jury considered there was actual force, and anything having to do with constructive force was harmless error?
Your Honor, in the Crudentis case, maybe mispronouncing it, this court recognized that when there's alternative theories of an offense, here constructive force or actual force, when there has been reversible error, and in that case it was a constitutional problem, it is impossible for the court to tell whether the members would have a finding of guilty based on the other alternative. We don't know what the members found. The hands on the shoulder, grabbing the breast, saying don't scream, all of that could easily be suggestive of consensual sex. And we don't know that that's not how the members saw it. When you had the constructive force instruction in there, it gave them the ability to say, well, we don't have to figure that one out. We're just going to say he's an ultrasound technician. She was getting an ultrasound done, so constructive force. It was too simplistic an analysis on the part of the military judge.
Thank you. You have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for the government.
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Major Kimani Eason. I'm joined by Lieutenant Colonel Robert Combs, and together we represent the United States in this proceeding. The military judge did not abuse her discretion when she denied a defense's challenge for cause against Major Houth and Captain Alvidres. The test is viewed through the eyes of the public and focusing on the perception of appearance of fairness in the military justice system, whether most people in the same position as the court members would be prejudiced or biased. Now, in this particular case, we have a perfect example of an individual who was biased or who had an implied bias, and that was Lieutenant Lopez. Lieutenant Lopez was challenged for cause. And the reason being was he had a daughter who was sexually abused when she was 7 years old. And the court asked several questions. And the answers that were given by Lieutenant Colonel, or Lieutenant Lopez, was that he blamed himself for what happened. He believes he failed his daughter and that he should have known of the danger. He was still angry with the mother. In fact, at the time of trial, he wouldn't allow the daughter to talk to the mother. And he stated that he didn't believe that what happened to his daughter would affect his abilities in carrying out his duties as a court member. But when asked if he thought he could sit and listen to testimony about rape or sexual assault and not be overly impassioned by it, Lieutenant Lopez responded, and I quote, "I don't understand until it happens, maybe. You know, if I start getting flashbacks about what may have happened to my daughter, then I don't know how I would react. I purposely don't want to think about it. It makes me sick to my stomach, but can I be impartial in this case? I think so, because I see my daughter. She's my child." He actually believed that he could be impartial. The military judge granted the challenge because, although he stated that he could be fair and impartial right now, there may be some testimony that would come out that would cause those flashbacks, and we want fairness in the hearing, in the beginning of the hearing as well as at the end of the hearing. Such was not the case with Major Hoth or Captain Alvarez. Major Hoth's wife was sexually abused by her stepfather. The conversation between about the sexual abuse hasn't come up with his wife in at least 5 years. The actual sexual abuse took place more than 10 years ago. The wife made no formal allegation. She did not seek counseling. In fact, there was a reconciliation. There appeared to be a reconciliation with his wife and her stepfather by the fact that the stepfather takes pictures of him while she does the Indian dances, and that as recently as 2 years ago, the wife, along with her mother and the stepfather, went to India together.
What indication in the record is there that the military judge applied the liberal grant mandate to these two challenges?
Your Honor, there was no indication. She did not apply the liberal grant mandate.
Why should we be looking to see whether the military judge abused her discretion in failing to apply the liberal grant mandate or in failing to grant on the grounds of implied bias, and is there a difference?
Your Honor, there is a difference. With the liberal grant mandate, it is an abuse of discretion. With the implied bias, and I point to, in answering this question, the Downing case, in that particular case, the military judge did not use the liberal grant mandate, and the court stated that she could have used the liberal grant mandate to challenge the member. However, she wasn't required to do so. And the same is true in this particular case. She could have used the liberal grant mandate in order to challenge Major Hoth or Captain Alvarez, but she was not required to do so in this particular case. When we talk about...
I don't understand that. Is the liberal grant mandate discretionary? No, I don't understand that response.
Yes, Your Honor.
So it's the liberal grant suggestion. That's the role of the court.
That's the government's understanding of the rule of the court. Yes, Your Honor.
Is that what we said in Leonard?
What this honorable court stated in Leonard was that where there is no actual bias, implied bias should be invoked rarely. And so there was no actual bias in this particular case, and based on that...
I'm asking about the liberal grant mandate. What did we say in Leonard about the liberal grant mandate?
As far as the court, I do not have that with me.
Again, we note that this court has enjoined military judges to follow a liberal grant mandate in evaluating challenges for cause because of implied bias. for cause because implied bias is reviewed under an objective standard through the eyes of the public, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Okay. Therefore, in this context, if we've enjoined military judges to follow a liberal grant mandate in evaluating challenges for implied bias, why shouldn't a liberal grant mandate have been followed in this case? Here you have someone who's on trial for rape, and it appears that all the potential members have connections to victims of people who've been raped. Why not just toss them and get people who don't have that connection?
That's a difficult question to answer. She could have done that. There's no doubt that she could have done that. If she had done that, obviously we wouldn't be here today. However, again, she was not required to do that because viewed from an objective standard, viewed from the eyes of a reasonable person, the fact that Major Hoth or Captain Alvedra is sitting on this court does not cast substantial doubt as to the fairness of this proceeding, viewed in the eyes of the objective person. And that's indicated by what Major Hoth and Captain Alvedrez stated during voir dire. Clearly, and as the military judge pointed out when she denied the challenge, their demeanor did not give the presence of any type of bias. And I understand that the military judge's personal perception goes to actual bias, but again, giving the judge some deference, it can also be applied to implied bias. Neither Captain Alvedrez or Major Hoth gave the appearance that they would be impartial in this case. They answered the questions straightforward, forthrightly, is what the judge stated. And there's no doubt from a reasonable person that they would be unfair in this case.
Well, given that under the implied bias rule, we give less deference than we do for actual bias, and given the fact that the military judge did not talk about or apparently apply the liberal grant rule, and that indicates that we should give probably less deference in those situations, we're kind of in a situation where wherever we're starting, we're giving less deference and less deference to that decision on implied bias. Given that standard, where should we end up here? Same place? Much of your argument, you have said that we should give deference to the military judge.
Yes, sir.
And my point is that under our rules, it appears that we should hardly give any deference to the military judge, given the fact that we're dealing with implied bias and given the fact that the military judge failed to recognize or apply the liberal grant rule.
The government would disagree with that. I think the better course of action, I guess, you know, where do we go from here? It sounds like that's kind of where the question is as far as the deference is concerned. When talking about implied bias, I think where jurors, you know, emotional attachment to an issue or to a participant in the case, and I'm quoting from the Downey case, Judge Crawford's concurring opinion, the application must be limited, quote, to those exceptional and extraordinary circumstances where a juror's emotional attachment to an issue or participant in the court proceeding was such that it was very unlikely by any objective measurement that an average person could remain impartial in deciding the merits of the case. So, I mean, the best way I can answer that is with that particular quote. That's where we should go, and hopefully I answer the question.
Do we have to give deference to the military judge's decision in order for you to prevail? Or, for instance, if we looked at this with a de novo standard, would you still prevail?
I think looking at it under even a de novo standard, we could prevail. However, there should be some deference given to the military judge based on the fact that she observed.
No, that's actual bias. We're looking at the perception of the public here. We're not talking about the military judge's perception.
So here we have, with respect to Alvarez, the military judge saying, I didn't see a demeanor that indicated there were some feelings. I think there were feelings that he had a girlfriend, but he indicated that he could put that aside and be fair and impartial. So from the perspective of the public, it appears to be the government's view that an individual who was in a relationship that he anticipated would lead to marriage, a relationship in which his understanding of his potential marriage partner was that she had not engaged in sexual intercourse, and that was very important to her that she not engage in sexual intercourse, and that after she was raped, she was so embarrassed and guilty by that, that she no longer wanted to have a relationship with him and terminated the possibility of marriage, but that the feelings were so strong that she nonetheless named the child, apparently the child that was the product of the rape, after him, that would have no impact on him as far as being able to sit on a case involving rape, and that the public would understand that person that who had gone through all those experiences wouldn't be affected by them in terms of their ability to judge a rape case.
I think the public would understand, given those facts, and the fact that he also met another young woman, married her, had been married to her for a period of 6 years, has not spoken to this other young lady, the fact that he states that he could be impartial, which I understand does go to actual bias again, but the fact that he states that he can be impartial in this case and that he has no lingering effects at the time of trial.
Where in the record would we look to see that he has no lingering effects from this? I understand where he said he could be impartial, but where did he say he has no lingering effects from this?
He didn't use the term no lingering effects, but however, on page 142, when asked about how he felt about the situation at the time of the court, he responded, quote, every incident is different. I view everything for what it's worth. If the evidence or whatever happened with her, I judge that one the way it happened to her. And if anything else happens, I'm impartial. So.
Counsel, I'm sorry, I don't understand what that sentence means at all. I've tried to diagram it, deconstruct it, and I can't figure out what he was trying to say there.
And there's nothing in the record to indicate this next statement, but it appears that he might be of Spanish descent, which explains how, I guess, the way he was talking, but it appears to me that...
I'm not trying to be critical of him for his answer at that point. The responsibility rests with either the trial counsel who is questioning him or the judge at that point to put on the record, well, what does that mean in terms of your answer to the question? The question was, how do you feel about that situation in that incident today as you sit here, and he wandered off into some other thoughts.
Right, but I think what he was trying to come to was that situation was what it was. It happened, it's unfortunate. However, here today, this is an entirely different matter. And I need to judge this based on the facts that it presented to me in trial and the instructions as given by the military judge, and that's why I think that's where he was going with that sentence.
But that doesn't say that it has no lingering effect or even a strong effect on him. It says that he understands that his role there today is to put that aside and be impartial.
Right.
And then the question for the judge at the time and for us is, would an objective observer looking at that say that we could expect the average person to be able to put those incidents aside and be impartial?
I think so. I'm sure. And the reason being, again, and the only thing we have, I think, is the military judge's observations of this particular member. And I understand the court believes that goes to actual bias. But also, the objective observer observes this individual as well. And based on his answers to the questions, and her observations, this is why I believe that some deference should be given to the military judge, but based on her observations, she believed that he was sincere and honest with his answers and that he truly could sit impartially in this case.
Thank you.
Counsel, the military judge didn't talk about implied bias or about the liberal grant rule, which makes your position a little difficult, but the CCA did. The CCA did a pretty good analysis on implied bias and also mentioned that they considered the liberal grant rule in affirming that action. How do we treat that? Does that rehabilitate the military judge's decision? Is that something that we should take into consideration, or does that fit into the overall consideration?
I think that that is something that this honorable court should take into consideration. Findings by the Air Force Court of Appeals in making its decision. Yes.
Is that any different, for example, in a search and seizure case, which the Court of Criminal Appeals reaches a conclusion as to whether the search was supported by probable cause or not? We look at that and we give respect to it, that in the sense that we give respect to fellow judges as to how they decide a case. But is it in any way binding or something that we give deference to as opposed to respect that we would give to anyone who has given thoughtful consideration to a matter?
No, it appears not, because the court conducts a de novo review on the search and seizure issue. However, in this particular case, I don't think de novo is the standard that should be used here. I think I think because the military judge was there, that she did observe these members, some deference, more than de novo, should be given in this case.
Is it deference when we're dealing with demeanor on an implied bias case, or is it a recognition that a thoughtful member of the public looking at the record would observe the judge's comments on demeanor and take that into account in determining whether there was bias or not? That's different from deference. Here it just becomes a factor.
Right.
And my understanding of our precedent is that it's simply a factor as opposed to deference that's taken into account on the issue of implied bias when the judge has made comments on demeanor.
Yes, the honorable court should, look at it in the eyes of the public, in the eyes of the reasonable person. I agree with that based on previous case law. But again, looking at that, there's no reason to believe that a member of the public, given the facts and circumstances of Major Hoth's and Captain Albedrez's situation, would not would feel that them staying on this case would somehow be unfair.
Let's look at the review the bidding on the totality of circumstances. I want to make sure that both sides have the opportunity to have every factor before us that they think is relevant. Can you please review your list with me of the factors you think are relevant? For example, demeanor, passage of time, lack of similarity on one side, you might say, and on the other side, you might point out the nature of what occurred, the relationship. And I want to make sure that you list all your factors, and then they have a chance to rebut any factors you put on the table or add to it. Have we, you follow?
Yes. Certainly those six factors that you listed, but not also...
Well, hang on. I didn't list anything. I was giving you examples of factors you might identify. Your job is to identify them.
Passage of time, situation, the effect on the member as of the time of the court, I think is probably the most important factor when you're talking about someone that that they knew who may have been a victim of a similar crime. How that member's relative or friend or significant other is handling the situation as of the time of court. Do they suffer from any lingering effects? One moment. And as well as the similarity and situation of the offenses. And I don't want this to be, I don't mean this to be an all-inclusive list, but those are some of the factors off the top of my head that I...
Is there anything in the record that would indicate a military necessity or military reason why these two members needed to sit on this panel?
No, Your Honor.
Counsel, could you move on to the constructive force instruction so
yes,
you get a chance to address that before your time expires?
The military judge did not abuse her discretion by giving a constructive force instruction. The instruction that the judge gave, heard in part, was that there's evidence which, if believed, indicated that the accused used or abused his position as an ultrasound technician in order to coerce or force Airman First Class S to have sexual intercourse. Specifically, I draw your attention to the accused worked as an ultrasound technician in the clinic. You may consider this evidence, in deciding whether A1CS had a reasonable belief that death or great bodily harm would have been inflicted on her and that resistance would be futile. This evidence is also part of the surrounding circumstances you may consider in deciding whether A1CS consented to the sexual intercourse. Based on his position as an ultrasound technician, he was able, just as the Air Force Court stated, he was able to create an atmosphere of trust when she went to see him on that Friday for an ultrasound. He used his trust to gain her cooperation to participate in his Saturday study. He then systematically isolated her, as this court recognized, in a small examination room. He used his expertise as an ultrasound technician to dominate and control her. It started out with the arms. Originally, he was supposed to do an ultrasound on the arms. However, supposedly, the veins were too small, so he asked to do an ultrasound on the legs.
Well, it sounds to me, counsel, that you're making the argument that constructive force in this case is based on deceit, that he deceived her as to the purpose for the exam, and which is what got her into the situation, rather than intimidation or threats that constructive force traditionally relies upon. Is my reading correct on that, or are you relying on intimidation and threats as well?
I think it's both deceit as well as the intimidation and threats, and specifically the constructive force. The ultrasound technician, as far as the intimidation and threats, I guess it kind of does go along with the deceit in the fact that he led her to the point of this small examination room and got her to an extremely vulnerable position based on his position as a ultrasound technician, to the point where she was lying on her stomach and he was able to penetrate her vaginally. I think that was all due to the fact that he was he abused his
deceit trust. Based upon on his position as a ultrasound technician.
Yes, Your Honor. And again, going back to your argument, I mean, he was able to have her take off her pants in an effort to do an ultrasound on her legs. He then went from the lower leg to the thighs to her groin area. She was wearing panties. In order to do an ultrasound on her groin area, she had to take off her panties, and which she did. And it went from external to internal inside her vaginal area, and it went from professional to sexual, ultimately to the point where he was able to rape her. And the construction force instruction, I mean, that's the purpose behind the construction force instruction, this particular situation here, abuse of trust. And there are no further questions on that. That concludes my argument.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Judge Erdman, in response to the issue you just raised about the deceit and Staff Sergeant Terry using his status as an ultrasound technician to deceive First Class S into coming for the study. Who knows? But it's important to recognize that this court has never held that deceit is automatically constructive force. If Sergeant Terry had told her on Friday that, or Saturday, that I need to insert my penis into your vagina in order to get a good ultrasound picture, and she believed him and didn't object, I think we'd have an argument that maybe that is constructive force by way of deceit. It's not what happened here. That deceit, and the Terry and the Air Force Court and Terry focused on that kind of analysis, that he used his position to get her to come there. But that's not what this is all about.
Well, I mean, isn't there an argument there? I mean, he used his position basically to say, I need help with my homework, and you can help me out. And her maybe unrealistic belief that she was doing that led her to be laying face down with no panties on, with her legs spread on an examination table, and boom, there was penetration. And that was due to her belief that she was there for a complete other purpose than sexual intercourse.
The record reflects that there was a point at which she realized that there was more going on here. She said that the internal probe started to feel sexual in nature.
And she said she was scared.
She said she was scared, but that she didn't say stop. He kept going further and told her to roll, to get on her stomach. There were just repeated times when she could have said stop.
She started to get up and he said stay there.
The record shows she started to move and he said, no, stay there. Could just as easily been stay there because that's the best position for sex. But instead of looking at the deceit as the Air Force Court did, what this court should look at is what constructive force was Staff Sergeant Terry exerting when he engaged in intercourse with her.
And it's your position this record does not reflect any constructive force?
None.
Okay.
No.
What distinguishes, in the case of Captain A, Captain A's circumstance from a per se rule about association with people who've been rape sitting as members in rape trials?
Well, Captain A, the government just stated that they can.
How would you distinguish his case from a per se rule?
I think that his responses to voir dire show that he had a personal impact that continues to today's comment about the law down there, the comment about the fact that...
Hang on, don't all persons who know people who are victims of crime have personal impact? What distinguishes his personal impact? Or are you advancing a per se rule?
No, we're not advancing a per se rule. He made it clear that he viewed this woman as somebody he would marry, and that the rape was the reason their relationship dissolved, and that he tried to help her through this process, but she pushed him away. Reading his response, the only logical conclusion that the military judge could arrive at was that this individual still has a real and honest effect because of that. Now, the government just stated that they consider the effect of a member the most important factor in the list of factors that they laid out in response to your question. Here, the impact on Captain Alvarez is significant. It makes it clear through his response. And that factor alone is enough for this court to set aside the verdict as they did in Leonard. I am out of time. If there are any other questions, I would be happy.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank the court for its time.
We thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today. The case is now submitted, and we will take a recess until 10 minutes after 10 to begin with the next case. Thank you. Our second case this morning is United States against Briggs. It's 15 minutes per side. Counsel for appellant.
Good morning. May it please the court. Chief Judge Efron, honorable members of the court, I am Captain Tim Cox, and along with Lieutenant Colonel Mark Strickland, represent the appellant, Tech Sergeant Cook Briggs, in this case. This case is nothing more and nothing less than about ensuring the appearance of a public, fair, and impartial trial when viewed through the eyes of the public. We are asking you to find that the military judge abused his discretion in denying the challenge for cause against Captain H for two reasons. First, the totality of circumstances and the liberal grant mandate weigh in favor of a finding of implied bias. And secondly, the military judge did not apply the correct standard when making his ruling. Now, at the outset, we are not asking for a per se exclusion of a member who is married to somebody who knows something about a case. We can envision many circumstances in which a person who is married to someone who has a connection to the case could sit on the panel and the public would not question the appearance of even fairness or impartiality of that member. This is not that case. Nevertheless, the close personal relationship of the spouse is the most close personal relationship perhaps that we have. And that cannot be discounted. And at the same time, what we are saying is that it is an important factor to consider in the totality of the circumstances. What makes this case different from a case where perhaps a spouse could sit on a court-martial panel is the nature of the crime, her prior knowledge of the crime, her connection to the appellant's immediate flight commander, the fact she knew he had been put on death duty prior to the trial, and the fact that this crime impacted her husband to some degree. Collectively, then, the totality of the circumstances would give substantial reason, in view to the eyes of the public, to question her ability to remain in judgment of the appellant. This is especially so given the inherent loyalty, trust, support, and fidelity one has with a spouse. Now, the crime itself involved Captain H's husband to a certain degree. This was a flight line crime. Her husband worked on the flight line. And during trial counsel's findings argument and rebuttal, there was no fewer than 7 references to the fact that this occurred on the flight line, affecting those who worked on the flight line and affecting those who worked on C-5s, which is exactly which Captain H's husband did for a living as appellant's immediate flight commander. And in addition, trial counsel argued during sentencing specifically about the mission degradation and the risk of safety of those working on the C-5s. It's not so much to ask, it's not so far-fetched to wonder, that when Captain H walked into that courtroom, what impact, if anything, did you crimes have on my husband? And if nothing else, what about the betrayal you had to my husband, who was your flight commander? Now, Captain H was aware that someone from her husband's squadron at the outset was involved in this crime, and albeit she admitted she didn't know which flight it was, but there were only 2 flights from which that person could have come from. Ultimately, she was going to learn that, yes, in fact, it was appellant that worked for her husband.
Counsel, are we looking just at the military judge's decision here, or are we also looking at the Court of Criminal Appeals decision, which did address implied bias?
That's correct. The CCA did address implied bias. What we're looking at is the military judge's decision.
And why aren't we looking at the CCA?
Because the CCA, first of all, is the military judge who's charged with the responsibility of impaneling the court-martial panel. And it's that military judge's discretion whether or not it was used properly when ruling on a denial of a challenge for cause.
Well, in United States versus Armstrong in 2000, we said that when the CCA is unable to determine from the record whether the military judge tested for implied bias, the CCA was empowered, indeed obligated, to make its own judgment if it believed that implied bias warranted the granting of challenge for cause.
That's correct. And that's exactly what Armstrong held. In Armstrong, the record was totally unclear, as well as whether or not the military judge allowed proper questioning to continue to determine whether or not implied bias was even there. And that's why the CCA could step in and do that. But that's not what the CCA did in this case. The CCA just went ahead and did the implied bias analysis. However, what it did not do, and completely silent in its opinion, is whether it even considered the liberal grant mandate. And that's why this court needs to step in and say, we have a liberal grant mandate for a reason. We have the implied bias analysis for a reason. And it's because the military judges are entrusted with that responsibility, and they're the ones that need to safeguard that.
And why isn't this an Armstrong situation? Explain that again.
Because what happened in Armstrong at the trial level is the military judge completely abandoned his role in developing the factual information whether or not to determine whether or not implied bias existed.
Well, I mean, in this case, the military judge focused on actual bias.
Correct.
And didn't deal with implied bias at all.
Correct.
So where's the difference?
The difference being is that what the CCA did in this case, essentially, really, is that we don't know if it even applied the liberal grant mandate. By at least applying the right standard, which they're allowed to do, but whether or not, in terms of it being an applied bias analysis, but we don't know whether or not it considered the liberal grant mandate.
Is your case dependent on a liberal grant mandate?
No, it is not. There would be implied bias because implied bias exists in this case. The liberal grant mandate requires a military judge to grant challenges liberally, and that would just further put it over the hump, if you will, that yes, in fact, this member should have been excused from the panel. But because we have a liberal grant mandate and the military judge is required to consider that in ruling, but didn't even articulate that in his ruling at all, which I'll get to in a minute, completely, therefore, abused his discretion.
Is there anything in the record from the appellant's standpoint that indicates a military necessity or need for these particular members to sit on this panel? Was there a shortage of officers who might serve as members?
No, sir. Not that we can discern from the record. Now, what we have to also understand in this case, when considering the totality of the circumstances, is that, yes, that Captain H had prior knowledge of this case, albeit minimal, from her husband. This was not from the base newspaper. It was not word of mouth from somebody else. This was from her husband, an inherently reliable source. Factually, this case, in terms of her prior knowledge of the case, is not terribly different from that of United States versus Vineyard. Now, obviously, that case, the factual difference that does exist is that the spouse was related to the lead investigator of the case. However, that investigator did not testify during the trial and was not a witness, not unlike Captain H's husband. The sentiment conveyed by Minyard would be what we would ask this court to apply in this case especially, where what we have is public confidence is that undermined by what is when you have a spouse related to somebody who is connected to the case. Now, the connection of Captain H's husband, albeit a little bit more tenuous than the lead investigator, still, we're looking at it through the eyes of the public. We're looking at public confidence, and we're looking at the appearance of fairness and impartiality. And what Minier was telling us when we addressed any kind of concern about per se is that it specifically told us that we're not doing a per se exclusion in this case. And the sentiment and the reasoning conveyed in Minier would apply in this case as well.
At the trial, at least at page 144, the argument of defense counsel appears to suggest a per se rule is what the defense counsel was asking for. That is, defense counsel said, we don't allow commanders to sit. That rule is established at a time when the composition of the military is different than it is today. So now we have a commander's spouse. Therefore, the commander's spouse shouldn't sit. That sounds like the defense counsel was making a per se argument to the judge. The judge didn't buy that. The argument that's being made now on appeal is that the case involved a specific impact on the unit and that the spouse would fear for the safety of the spouse member, would fear for the safety of the husband commander, and therefore the public would perceive that this is an unfair situation. I'm not sure I see that argument at trial. And if the argument wasn't made at trial, what impact does that have on us on appeal? That is, shouldn't the judge at trial have the opportunity to rule on that argument?
Yes, the argument was not made to the military judge. However, I would submit that the military judge is in a position to be sensitive to issues that maybe defense counsel might not raise, that the military judge should have an outlook towards what might happen during the trial. And the military judge in this case did intervene. On page 46, he did, when he's focusing on the relationship between Captain H and the appellant's flight commander, her husband, he just dismissed it as essentially he's not going to be a witness in this case. But I would submit that being a military judge and his experience in practicing in military justice, he would at least be sensitive to appreciate the potential, especially if you get to sentencing, that there might be some evidence of victim impact or unit impact. And he should have an eye towards that. So therefore, he would have to consider the nature of the relationship and how that's going to play into her deliberations, whether or not that personal bond is going to improperly find its way in the deliberation room, and determining whether or not the public would be concerned about her remaining on the panel sitting in judgment of the appellant.
I can see that in a case where something unusual happens at trial that reasonably wasn't anticipated at the time of voir dire. Here we have the charge itself being the charge of the stealing of the equipment and the false statements with regard to the equipment. Defense counsel was in as good position, wasn't the defense counsel as anybody else, to anticipate that unit impact on that loss could be a reasonable sentencing argument. And yet that wasn't brought up. Does that put us in a plain error situation?
No, it does not. The reason being, and I do not want to repeat myself, is that the military judge would also be in that same position. And I do believe because the military judge is in that position. Now, addressing the military judge's ruling in and of itself and why that was an abuse of discretion is because I think we pretty much made clear he did not consider implied bias. His ruling in that one page and the words that he used, appears to me, was all addressed at actual bias. And not once did he mention the words liberal grant mandate. Are there magic words required in the military judge's analysis? No, there's not. But this court has made it clear that the ruling still needs to send a clear signal that he applied the correct standard. Now, if he's going to put his analysis on the record, then yes, it's entitled to deference. But if he does put the analysis on the record and it's wrong or it's flawed or it's insufficient, then as we probably discussed earlier in the earlier argument, then no, he's not entitled to deference. being the gatekeeper of this trial and seeing the panel as he's responsible for doing, he needs to make sure that he has that discretion to go forward and do the right thing. That's why we are asking for the foregoing reasons that you find that he abused his discretion in denying the challenge for cause.
Thank you, counsel. You have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for the government.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Captain Daniel Brain, and together with Lieutenant Colonel Robert Combs, we represent the United States. In short, the government's position is that the military judge did not err in denying appellant's challenge for cause against Captain H in this matter. In looking at a reasonable member of the public, would they have substantial doubt as to the legality, fairness, or impartiality of the proceedings? And looking at implied bias, where would most people in the same position be prejudiced? The answer to both questions is no, that there was fair proceedings. And essentially, you're dealing with a very limited amount of facts that were presented to the judge that represented potential bias. They were the relationship with the husband, the limited knowledge of the facts of the case.
So is it the standard rule that we want members who have knowledge about a case to sit on as jurors?
Your Honor, would
that's
be
good practice?
It would be a very poor practice to have members with knowledge of a case to sit on a panel. And it's important for a military judge and for attorneys to test that knowledge to
see.
So
why isn't that this case?
In this case, the knowledge was so limited that it was virtually nil.
What was the knowledge?
The knowledge was that there were some vests that were missing and that someone had been placed on desk duty.
Did the wife know that this person had debt troubles?
No. The defense attorney did place Appellant Exhibit 2 into evidence, which showed where her husband had counseled appellant, but she did not have personal knowledge of that.
That the husband had counseled appellant, she did not know that?
She did not know that. And that's an important factor. When we're looking at this situation, a lot of times with implied bias, you're looking at one situation or another. It's either a situation of emotion or a situation of status.
Counsel, how much of that came out during the trial? Did it come out during the trial that her husband had counseled this individual?
Your Honor, I do not recall.
Well, did it come out during the trial that the individual had taken the survival gear from her husband's squadron?
Yes.
And if a member of the public was looking at this and saw that a member of a court-martial panel was the spouse of a pilot who was flying planes in combat zones, and that an individual had stolen survival gear from those planes, don't you think that that would give them the impression that that person wasn't completely unbiased?
Well, it could give the potential for that, but there's the understanding here that on a court-martial panel, you have all military members. All military members are going to know what an impact it could personally have on them or their friends.
Well, but not necessarily their spouse, which is a pilot in one of the planes in question.
Yes, Your Honor. But in this particular situation, there was also not evidence explored where there was a vest that her husband was potentially missing, that he was in any potential danger in Kuwait, or that she had any concerns. They had the full opportunity to go through those questions, and she didn't volunteer any of that information. It didn't appear on the record that that was really a concern. It would appear, due to how the judge responded, how frank she was, and how honest she was doing the answer, if she really had a concern in that area, that she would have volunteered it.
Well, but, I mean, a few minutes ago you were arguing that she didn't have very much knowledge of this case, and now you're arguing that she should have had knowledge of this case so she could have explained her position. One of the problems here is that, based upon her relationship, perhaps the implied bias problem didn't develop until the actual trial itself and this information came out. You see what I'm saying? It may not have come out on voir dire, but when we look at it for implied bias, the fact that she is the wife of the commander of this particular flight, that she knew that something had been stolen, and as the the case develops, and obviously the prosecutor and the parties knew which way the case was going, that this involved sensitive gear. I mean, I don't think we can say that survival gear is not sensitive, and that her husband was a pilot who relied on that gear.
Yes, Your Honor, but what that does is that creates a situation where you have a supposition on a supposition, and that's basically that at that point she would know that her husband was in danger, and we don't have anything in the record. We would have to make further assumptions that may have occurred. So a member of the public would have to look at the limited information that she knows.
It's not enough that this individual is stealing survival gear from a plane that her husband may be flying without actually proving that in fact happened, but the fact that he was taking survival gear from a plane that her husband would be on would not be enough to influence the public as to her feelings toward that individual.
No, Your Honor, it wouldn't, because that deals with the potential. In most of the instances that we have with implied bias that deal with emotion, what we generally have is you have somebody either reflecting on a trauma that they've experienced or that someone close to them have experienced. It's actual trauma itself. It's not a projection of possible trauma. If that were the case, then in a rape case, then any panel member who had a spouse would have potential bias toward a rapist because they could project in that same way. If we project out suppositions too far, then you can reach a point where you have no one that can sit on a panel.
And moving on a little bit, what's your position as to how we should treat the CCA's decision on implied bias?
This court should give great deference to the CCA's decision because they looked at the record cold. In looking at their decision, although they had particular cites to some of the questions that were asked, they really did not cite directly to how the judge ruled. So it appears from their ruling that they didn't give any direct deference to what the military judge ruled, and they said on the face of this, there's no implied bias. Because what they were looking at it in terms of was this really is a status situation. It can be argued different ways, you can look at it different ways, you can bring up new reasons, but this really is a status situation. Is her status such that it would require her to not sit on the panel? Because a member of the public would not want the wife of a commander sitting on the panel. That is the true analysis that this case has at trial. It had it before the Air Force Court, and it's before this court today.
What was the defense theory?
Well, the defense's theory at trial was it was a little confusing because they had a future bias element to it, which hasn't been addressed so much as we've gone into implied bias.
No, the theory of defense.
The theory of the defense to why they should be struck was the fact
no,
that...
No, their I'm theory sorry. Is to how were they defending against a crime? Did they argue that someone else did it? Didn't they argue? What were they arguing about who did it if they didn't do it?
Your Honor, I'm not prepared to answer that part.
Why aren't you prepared to answer that? Here, let me try the question.
Yeah, yes, Your Honor.
If they were to argue that, gee, I didn't do it and I don't know who did it and it was someone from off base.
Yes, Your Honor.
Did the Captain H know from her husband that the suspect was a member of the squadron?
Yes, Your Honor. She knew. She knew that a member of the squadron was placed on desk duty. She didn't know from her husband about the appellant.
Right. But now he gets up and he starts to defend the case on the grounds that he doesn't know who did it and he thinks it was someone from off base.
Right. Yes, Your Honor.
And she already knows from her husband that it wasn't someone from off base.
Well, she knows that someone was placed on desk duty and there was some discussion there about the fact that with the judge, hey, just because somebody's put on desk duty and there's a situation, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're the one that did it and that you can put that aside. You're not automatically going to determine that particular circumstance creates the fact that person did it.
Now, when the judge asked if there was any reason anybody should be, any members were aware of any grounds they might be challenged, what did Captain H do?
If I may have a moment.
It's not a trick question. I want to make sure my understanding of the facts are comparable to yours.
Yes, sir. I don't have in my mind.
I'm under the impression that she raised her hand, as in she self-selected as someone who might be susceptible to challenge. Putting aside the fact that we're not going to stipulate that's a fact yet.
Yes, Your Honor.
As a hypothetical, how should that play into the implied bias analysis? A captain, you know, saying, oh, yeah, I might be subject to challenge.
Yes, Your Honor, it cuts two ways, and you have to look at it a little deeper. If somebody raises their hand and says it's a possibility, the members are encouraged, if there's anything, to bring it forward. So in certain situations, it's where someone's really being honest and forthright with the court. It's a situation where you can give a lot of deference to what they're saying to the court. And there's other situations where the person is just so wrapped up in something that they can't serve on the court. And trial practitioners run into that constantly, where they'll have a member that'll raise their hand, and the situation will keep cropping up where they say, I don't know. They have a lot of hesitation in their answers. And they have different problems that they have.
So your position is should give us confidence in the outcome, because this person is eager to identify issues. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor. This isn't somebody that was playing hide the ball, where there would be something else. And another interesting aspect, in looking at the prior knowledge aspect, which is an important factor here, is Major Sheffield, who had read the newspaper article, and there was a lot of discussion with Major Sheffield about the newspaper article and what he knew. And essentially, in looking at those answers, Major Sheffield actually knew more about the case than Captain H did. So in that circumstance, the appellant did not feel that prior knowledge was sufficient, and I think that takes a little bit away from their argument at trial that knowledge of the case would have an impact on the member and would have an impact on the public's perception. And once again, it takes it back to the whole status situation.
Let's focus on that. Did you get an answer to your status situation? On page 13 of the defense brief, the defense states, during trial counsel's sentencing argument, trial counsel argued for punishment focusing on how the actions appellant was convicted of contributed to mission degradation and putting crew members' lives at risk. Is that a fair summarization of trial counsel's argument on sentencing?
Yes, Your Honor. It was tied into a whole general 9/11 type of war on terrorism and safety issue throughout the entire argument.
But it focused on this particular unit and the risk to the lives of this unit. And so my question is, what do we do with a situation where we're dealing with theft of equipment? The armed forces have lots of equipment, and normally the theft of an equipment is a problem for logistics managers and the taxpayers, but doesn't necessarily impact on a particular unit. Now we have a situation which at sentencing, the trial counsel has said, this unit, i.e. your husband's command, their lives are now at risk as a result of this. Does that take us away from a per se rule concern and now into whether in this particular case information was reasonably anticipated, at least by the trial counsel, to be brought out during sentencing? And why doesn't that have an impact on the implied bias situation?
Sure, it takes it a little away because it starts to bring a little bit of emotion into it. But in the context of the argument itself in the case, when we're talking about the mission degradation, putting crew members' lives at risk, they weren't referring to specific instances of situations. They were trying to draw some emotion into it in order to impact sentencing. But this doesn't necessarily mean that it had an impact on this particular member or that somebody from the public would perceive such an impact.
So nobody at this unit had their lives put at risk by the appellant's actions?
There's no direct evidence that they provided that someone's life was put at risk. It's the general. When you're missing gear, there's the opportunity, obviously, if you can't use the gear, that your life is going to be at risk, and it's a very sensitive situation. And it would be a very sensitive situation for every panel member.
So it wasn't focusing on this particular unit or the crew members of this unit? The trial counsel was saying this is a general problem for the Air Force and not for this unit?
Well, in context of the whole argument, it was, it's a general problem for the Air Force, it's a general problem with fighting for terrorism, and then seized upon that one statement to tie it directly into the unit. And
okay, that answers my question.
Was this equipment in a restricted area?
It was, the understanding is that it's locked away and it required someone to have access to it in order to get to it.
Was it described as a restricted area?
I don't recall that exact terminology used.
And is it clear that this, the accused or the appellant was in, this guy was the CO of the appellant?
Well, he was the flight commander of the appellant, which is a little different. It's more of a supervisory status than being...
Because the squadron commander is the CO, or what?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Does it reflect well on a flight commander that someone in their unit's stealing from the unit and they don't know it?
It could potentially. There were multiple flights, and at this point of the trial, it was undetermined who had done it, if it was from either unit.
But my question is, would it reflect well if you were a battalion commander or a company commander and equipment that you were charged with was being stolen from underneath your command? Would that reflect well on the unit?
It would not reflect well on the unit. No. And it could impact negatively on that particular individual or officer in charge, especially if they weren't doing
so. Why isn't that an area of concern for implied bias? You've been discussing in terms of impact on the husband captain. We're debating about safety and whether he was going to be in an aircraft that didn't have a vest or something. But what about the fact that he's the guy responsible and this stuff was stolen when he was responsible?
Well, the ultimate responsibility falls in many hands. I don't necessarily see that such a situation, a member who's an officer of the military would abandon their officership in order to either punish or harm somebody for something that's tangential.
But that's
because
an actual...
Because if it had an impact on him, then she probably would have known that. Because he would have said, there's some stuff missing, and I'm being blamed for it. It's a problem for me, and there's no evidence of that in the case.
You may briefly conclude.
Your Honor, if there are no further questions, that concludes my...
Thank you.
Thank you.
Does the defense have rebuttal?
Government counsel talked about assumptions and supposition based on supposition based on supposition. Our point is merely this. There is reasonable inferences that can be drawn, and those reasonable inferences are based on the facts of this case. We're not asking this court, in this case or in any case, to make suppositions or assumptions. We're asking them to make reasonable inferences. And those inferences are reasonable based on the nature of a husband-wife relationship. And while facts might have not have been explored during voir dire, those reasonable inferences still remain, regardless of whether or not the military judge sees them, defense counsel sees them, or the CCA sees them. They're still apparent and still can be discussed when reviewing this issue. Secondly, there was a point made about Major Sheffield and her knowledge of the case. Well, what Major Sheffield actually was able to tell us was how well-known this crime was throughout the flight line, which is where Captain H's husband worked. But then again, most importantly, Major Sheffield is not married to anybody connected to the trial. Also, Major Sheffield essentially, though, was excused primarily, if I would submit, is that she already formulated an opinion about guilt. So her knowledge of the case really just more goes about how well-known this was throughout the flight line. And then just finally, the entire government sentencing case was about unit impact. There was one sentencing witness, Senior Master Sergeant Bloomer, and his testimony went directly to the impact on the unit as related to safety, the C-5s, and the survival vests, and the survival equipment. Trial counsel sentencing argument just brought it home for someone who was connected to somebody who worked within that realm, in that arena. Trial counsel argued for 10 years punishment, confinement. Ultimately, he was sentenced to 4 years. Defense counsel just argued for not lengthy confinement. There's no doubt that the entire sentencing case was based on the emotion and passion of the time and the nature of the crime, which is where Captain H's husband worked. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We thank both counsel for your presentation today. The case is now submitted. We'll recess until 10:45. Thank you. This morning is United States against Casio.
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel for appellant.
Chief Judge Efron, judges of this honorable court, may it please the court, I'm Captain John Fredlin. Lieutenant Colonel Mark Strickland and I are representing the appellant in this case, Airman Basic Jose Casio. Your Honor, the government threw the appellant in pretrial confinement for almost 4 months and formulated charges against him, but dragged its feet in preferring and investigating the charges and in docketing the case, all the while hoping that a government lab's review of forensic evidence from 5 computers seized from his mother's home would allow it to add on some additional charges. The appellant promptly demanded a speedy trial and moved the trial for the charges and specifications to be dismissed for a violation of Article 10 of the UCMJ. The military judge ruled that the government was not reasonably diligent, and he dismissed the charges with prejudice. Now, before this court today is an issue that is best viewed through a two-part framework. First of all, the military judge correctly dismissed the charges for the government's violation of the appellant's right to a speedy trial. Second, that the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals applied an incorrect standard of review when they set aside the military judge's ruling. First of all, the military judge was right. This court has consistently maintained that Article 10 provides service members with more rights in the speedy trial arena than the Sixth Amendment gives to citizens in general. But this court has said that the 4 Barker v. Wingo factors are an apt foundation for the analysis. And essentially, this analysis is a balancing test, which is based on the military judge's findings of fact relating to 4 factors. On one side of the balance, you have the length of delay, prejudice to the appellant, and whether the appellant had demanded a speedy trial. On the other side, you have the government's reason for the delay. Ultimately, the military judge makes a conclusion of law, and that conclusion is whether the government was reasonably diligent. And another way of looking at it would be whether the reason for the delay is significant enough to outweigh the other 3 factors. Standard of review, the findings of fact is whether the military judge was clearly erroneous, and the conclusion of law is reviewed de novo. Now, in the appellant's case, the findings of fact on that first side of the scale are analytically simple and leave little room for dispute. The length was 117 days, simple, the span between being apprehended and confined on 5 October of 05 and being arraigned on 30 January of 06. The prejudice, the judge found, was the prejudice inherent in pretrial confinement. An appellant promptly demanded a speedy trial 23 days after being apprehended and confined. Now, when those 3 factors are taken to the conclusion of law stage, they present a significant amount of weight. Because if you look at this court's precedents on the length factor, the predecessor to this court said in Kosman that we happen to think that 3 months is a long time to languish in a brig awaiting an opportunity to confront one's accusers. On the prejudice factor, it's worth noting that when the Supreme Court drafted Barker, it drafted it with the idea that it would apply both to individuals in pretrial confinement and out of pretrial confinement. So in that universe, pretrial confinement is a leg up as far as prejudice. And the language in the opinion talks about the time being spent in jail as simply dead time. That suggests the court did not view pretrial confinement as any mere hindrance, that it was a somewhat substantial prejudice. And then on the demand for the speedy trial factor, the Supreme Court said that it should get strong evidentiary weight. So then the analysis shifts with those three factors to the reason for the delay. And what we're looking for here is why the arraignment was on 30 January rather than on some other date. The most user-friendly way of looking at the military judge's findings of fact on this issue is to break down the pre-arraignment span into five segments that necessarily had to follow each other. First of all, you have 21 days, 5 October to 26 October, for apprehending, confining, reviewing the confinement, and evaluation by the Wing Legal Office of Evidence and Law related to the charges. Second, you have 27 days from 26 October 2005 until 22 November 2005 for pre-preferral review and preferral. And this was because the headquarters felt the need to review and review again the charges, and also because the immediate commander was not available. Third, 22 days from 22 November 2005 to 14 December, and that would be the delay in getting the Article 32 investigation going. And there, the reasons are that they had to appoint first one IO and then a second IO. The defense wasn't notified then for a couple of days after that, and then the defense had to request a delay because of its schedule. Fourth, you have 16 days from 14 December 2005 to 30 December 2005 for the IO to complete his report and for the commanding authority to refer the charges. And then fifth, you have 31 days, 30 December 2005 to 30 January 2006 for referral to arraignment, and that would involve a couple of days delay in getting the IO report and charges to the defense, and also the judiciary's disinclination to rearrange the docket to accommodate McCullen's case. But one of the significant aspects, though, isn't included with those findings of fact, but it's essentially a complementary finding, and it's that the delay in getting the forensic evidence of the computer back from the DCFL, the Defense Computer Lab, was not the reason for the delay in an Article 10 sense. So consequently, this court can find, as the government has urged in its briefs, both at the Air Force court level and this court level, and also how the Air Force court ultimately found, that that was the reason for the delay, only if the military judge's ruling was clearly erroneous.
Well, counsel, how do you respond to the CCA decision and the government's argument that the military judge went beyond his fact-finding authority in the findings of fact, and that he included a number of comments and speculations that they really don't have to pay any attention to? I mean, the day count is the day count. Where we get into the controversy in this case is whether or not the reasons for the delay in each one of those segments was reasonable. The military judge found that they were not. And it appears to me that the CCA said that the military judge's reasons for that were not findings of fact, but rather just speculative comments.
Yes, Your Honor. And the term that the Court of Criminal Appeals used there was that they were opinions. And our position on that is that, first of all, there's no precedent in this court's jurisprudence or anywhere else for saying that it should be reviewed as a fact, opinion, conclusions of law, trichotomy, that opinions exist in that universe, that it's either facts or it's conclusions of law. Additionally, if you look at
just the fact that he included it in the section that says findings of fact doesn't make it a finding of fact. I mean, a military judge can certainly make what is clearly a conclusion of law and miscategorize it. I mean, where it falls in the opinion shouldn't be determinative, should it?
Yes, Your Honor, but what we're saying is, for analytical purposes, everything in there has to be viewed as a fact or as a conclusion of law. The jurisprudence doesn't allow, because what
counsel, which of the items labeled as opinion by the Court of Criminal Appeals would not constitute conclusions of law? I mean, if they've got to either be fact or conclusion of law, which of them are not conclusions of law and are instead facts?
Yes, Your Honor. I'll give you some examples here. The belief that the case would not involve extensive preparation, that we submit is a finding of fact and not an opinion. Because in order to make the conclusion that a certain delay is necessary or reasonable or anything like that, it is essential to know where the government was, with whether they were ready to go forward or whether they were fishing around unnecessarily. And so something like that is necessarily going to be, for analytical purposes, a fact.
Well, is there a difference between the fact, that is, the government was in fact ready to go forward, as opposed to the government was unreasonable in not being ready to go forward? The one, if the military judge finds on such and such a date, the trial counsel put a memo in the file or said to somebody that we're ready to go forward, versus the other, the judge looking at the case and saying it was unreasonable for the government not to be ready to go forward on that date.
Yes.
What do we have here? Do we have the judge finding historical facts, or do we have the judge make a conclusion as to whether the government was ready to go forward or not? That conclusion may be correct, but why isn't that a conclusion of law?
It's a finding of fact because ultimately the conclusion of law, because it's something short of the ultimate conclusion of law in this case, which is reasonable diligence. It's something that supplements that. Additionally,
do we have any case law that says only the ultimate conclusions are conclusions of law? My understanding of our jurisprudence, particularly in the search and seizure area, confession area, is that those matters which are not historical facts and which contribute greatly to the ultimate conclusion of law have been treated as conclusions of law on our part.
I don't know of any case law for that proposition, Your Honor.
Whether it goes to reasonableness or not.
Yes, Your Honor. Although we would submit that it's a difference in, from what you were saying before, the subjective notion that the government is ready to go versus the objective notion, was the government ready to go, looking in at what they had. Although the subjectivity can be a part of that, but ultimately it's the objective view of the judge, and we submit that that is a finding of fact and should have been addressed as such by the Court of Criminal Appeals rather than merely dismissed as an opinion.
The determination as to when a case is ready to proceed is a highly discretionary matter. How does one determine, as a matter of fact, what the proper exercise of discretion was at that time, as opposed to a matter of law? That is, the government, whether or not objectively they should have been ready to go, if the government counsel was not, in fact, prepared to go forward, then is that a question of fact or a question of law when we're looking at the question of the reasonable diligence here? Why isn't that a question of law? That is, the government would say, we weren't ready to go. And the judge would say, that's unreasonable. You had all the facts you needed. The question that whether they had all the facts they needed, that's a historical fact the question of what facts they had, those are historical facts. The question of whether they had all the facts they needed, that's a subjective decision at that point, which bears directly on reasonableness. How can the judge say, as a matter of fact, they had all the facts that they needed, when the prosecution is making this discretionary decision as to whether to go ahead or not?
They can say that, Your Honor, because if you look at the evidence at the time, because we're going from evidence, all these little points of evidence out there, up to a conclusion or a finding of fact. When you look at the evidence at the time and you see that they weren't saying, well, we're concerned that if we don't get this report, we're going to lose on the charges that we have. You can look for statements like that. Instead, in this case, you find statements that we're fine with going ahead with these charges. We don't see any problems. If you look through the pre-preferral review and any of the other paperwork beforehand.
And those all stand for the proposition that counsel had no reason to want to be extra cautious and extra sure? It appears to be common knowledge that prosecutors typically will over-prepare a case, not knowing exactly how it's going to turn out at trial. Are we to say that that's unreasonable for counsel to do that? And if we're going to say that that's unreasonable, what historical facts is that based on? Would that be based on?
As far as saying that it's unreasonable, Your Honor, what we would submit is that the government's power is always going to be limited necessarily by the Sixth Amendment and by Article 10. So while the government has the ability to go forward, it's necessarily going to be limited by, in this case, that they have a service member in confinement and that they have a speedy trial request and that the days are building up.
So here we have a judge looking at that case saying the government had enough evidence to go forward. Why does that equate into, therefore, it was unreasonable for the government to want to obtain more evidence? Why, from an Article 10 perspective, shouldn't the government have the opportunity to insulate itself against loss of evidence, witness failures, other problems that may occur in a case, and build up more evidence than the minimum that they need to go forward? I understand ultimately that can translate into delay at some point, but that then would be a judgment that all those facts lead to a conclusion that it was unreasonable.
Because ultimately there has to be some sort of limitation on that. That's what we're saying. And for example, from the Court of Criminal Appeals opinion, it looks like they presume, without any investigation either way, that 3.5 months of investigation is reasonable, that there is some sort of presumption of reasonableness. The government does its investigation, and that's great. They don't look in any deeper to see, well, maybe they should have been cracking the whip on DCFL harder. Maybe they should have explored other labs, a civilian lab or something like that. There's none of that. And so what we're saying is that there has to be some sort of limit if Article 10 and if the Sixth Amendment are going to mean anything.
Right, but then, aren't those questions of law? I'm not suggesting here which way or that issue should come out. But if the military judge says the government should have stopped at a particular point and anything beyond that was unreasonable, whether it's an opinion or whatever else the judge is labeling it at that point. And the Court of Criminal Appeals says, no, it was okay for the government to go beyond that point. Aren't we dealing there with questions of law or mixed questions of law and fact, which ultimately it's our decision as to how we should go with that, as opposed to being bound by any views that the judge or the Court of Criminal Appeals said, giving those proper respect? But nonetheless, why aren't those conclusions of law as to whether it was reasonable to stop at any particular point?
Well, ultimately, what we would say would be, it seems like what we're getting at is a finding that the reason was, well, we needed 3.5 months. Then that just shifts the analysis. And then the question is, ultimately, is that reasonable diligence? That's how that factors in. You put in your new reason, and then you get to the question of, was it reasonable to spend 3.5 months investigating? and that would be your conclusion of law. But the finding of fact underneath that is, what is the reason for the delay? And in this case, the reason was, according to the judge's findings, it was not the computer. And if the Air Force Court wants to submit the computer delay, then that would just shift the analysis around, saying the reason was that it took us 3.5 months to evaluate the computer, and then you have to determine whether that were the 5 computers, and then you have to determine whether that's reasonable.
What is your position ultimately on whether the computer forensics, how it plays in? Are you saying that the government should have moved with reasonable diligence independent of the computer forensic piece?
Our position is that the government needed to make, through its paper trail and through its actions, a better case for why the reason for the delay was the computer results. Or, alternately, they needed to speed up the computer process, getting the computer reviewed.
When you originally went through the 5 periods of time, you specifically stated that the forensic evidence was not part of the equation. So what should have the government done during those 5 periods of time to exercise due diligence that they did not do?
Yes, Your Honor. During the first period, we don't see any problem with that. 21 days for apprehension and evaluation of the evidence doesn't seem to be unreasonable. The second period, though, 27 days for pre-preferral review and preferral. What we see unreasonable there is the extensive time that this case was up at the MAGCOM, and we'll point out with that it's the government's burden of persuasion here, and they could have called the major who was up at the MAGCOM evaluating it to say why it was necessary to review it not once but twice, but they did not do that, so we don't know. We have a hearsay statement from the deputy saying that she said that she's been really busy, but that wasn't scrutinized by the court. And additionally, the delay of a few days because the immediate commander was not available, delaying preferral there. Third delay.
And that's unreasonable for the commander not to be available in the context of ongoing war? Are you saying that's unreasonable, or just you're just pointing that out?
No, Your Honor. I'm not saying that it's unreasonable for the commander to be away. Although it was not really pinned down in the record why the commander was away, but the point was that it was possible for someone else to prefer charges. It did not have to be the squadron commander. It could have been the group commander, for example. But there's no sense that they said, well, we have someone in confinement. Let's try to see if we can get...
So the unreasonableness was not that the commander was away. Is that they didn't work around that? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. What's your next period of time?
Third, 22 days, 22 November to 14 December. And that would be the Article 32 investigation, that the time from preferral to 32 did not have to be quite that long. And what we would submit there would be they could have had the IO lined up beforehand, especially once they knew on the 17th that they were all ready to go on preferral. But then they didn't appoint an IO until the 23rd, and then they appointed someone else on the 29th. And they didn't notify the defense until the 1st. And then the defense requested a delay after that.
Just jumping in, in the end, when does the clock stop?
In this case, Your Honor, or just in general?
In concept.
In concept, it stops when you get to trial. This is where Article 10 is...
Now, why didn't the government... Are you arguing that the government did not need to wait for its forensic evidence?
Based on the facts on the record, yes, Your Honor.
Should have proceeded without the report from the computer people?
Yes, or they should have explored other possibilities.
And that would have been reasonable?
Yes.
So that, does your argument ultimately depend on us reaching that conclusion? That the government should have proceeded without that forensic report?
No, it doesn't, Your Honor, because the government had other possibilities. Because if you look, the lab report could have been done faster.
But that, that's what I'm getting back to. Is the issue those five periods of time and dissecting them, or is the issue the lab report?
The issue is based on the military judge's findings of fact, which need to be clearly erroneous to be overturned. This is much more than just mere erroneous. This is, but he was way out there in making these, that based on those, that's where the five periods come into play. But that also that the government could have gotten forensic results in, but that it was also unreasonable in not pushing the lab along a little bit harder. It was a government lab.
Can I restate my question and try something? Let's say we'll stipulate that in your five periods, the government set both new records for diligence and speed and thoroughness at the same time. And the lab report, so they were ready, all that stuff happened, except for obviously moving forward to trial, in 10 days. And the lab report comes back when it comes back in January. Are you still up here? Or would you be arguing they should have proceeded back on October 10th?
No, Your Honor, I wouldn't be.
Why not?
Because then the reason would look more like the lab report. And then at that point, then we would say that it's unreasonable to spend 3.5 months on a lab report when someone is in confinement.
Counsel, you have a further opportunity on rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Counsel for the government.
May it please the court, my name is Captain Donna Rappel, and I, along with Lieutenant Colonel Robert Combs, represent the government in this matter. The single issue in this case is whether the military judge erred in granting a defense motion to dismiss based on a denial of his right to a speedy trial under Article 10, Uniform Code of Military Justice. In order to make this determination, the court should apply the four factors laid out by the Supreme Court in Barker versus Wingo. The defense already went through which the four factors are, and based on the facts in this case, the issue focuses on the second factor, reasons for the delay. In this case, the government acted with reasonable diligence through the entire processing of this case. There was extensive expert forensic investigation required on a large amount of computer evidence seized, including 5 hard drives, 61 CDs, and 15 floppy disks. The government never stopped processing this case. There was no foot dragging and no evidence of foot dragging. As a matter of fact, in the military judge's findings of fact, he states that pre-preferral reviews, preferral, the Article 32 hearing, referral, and the trial date was all set without the benefit of the Defense Computer Forensics Laboratory report or the Office of Special Investigations report. As a matter of fact, the final report in this case was received on the 25th of January, and trial began on the 30th of January. A mere 5 days before trial, the final report was received.
So is it typical for the government to charge a person and bring him up to the eve of trial without having evidence that could convict him?
No, Your Honor, that is not typical at all. Typically, the process is that you would receive the evidence, and then do your research, determine what charges are appropriate.
But is that what happened in this case?
No, Your Honor, that's not what happened in this case. This case was an anomaly based on...
No, I'm saying in this case, the government didn't have what you're terming the crucial evidence until essentially the eve of trial.
That is correct, Your Honor.
And that this individual was held in pretrial confinement without the government having the evidence that was necessary for them to convict him at trial. Is that correct? At that point, they didn't know what the forensic report was going to say.
That is correct, Your Honor. However, the government did have some evidence that would go towards numerous charges. But there is a difference between having some evidence or enough evidence to hold the accused in pretrial confinement versus having the complete investigation done and all the evidence that the government would generally have prior to going to trial. There was some evidence that the government did have at hand when they put the appellant into pretrial confinement. However, they did not have the amount of evidence required to go to trial successfully.
It seems to me that the major or a major contention in this case is how we are categorizing the military judge's findings or conclusions. I mean, that seems to be the question, as to whether the individual delays were reasonable.
Yes, Your Honor.
And I'm assuming it's the government's position that in that process itself is a conclusion of law.
Yes, Your Honor. There are many statements in the military judge's findings of fact that the government would argue are not actual findings of fact, which are held to the clearly erroneous standard, but are, in fact, conclusions of law and opinions.
Well, the military judge finds, like, in this particular segment, there is 22 days of delay.
Yes, Your Honor.
And then he said, these are the reasons for the delay, and I don't find those to be sufficient. I find that this was unreasonable.
Yes, Your Honor.
That, in your view, is a conclusion of law.
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, go ahead.
Is it your position that the individual segments are each in their own right reasonable, or that they are reasonable in light of the fact that in any event the government was waiting for the forensic report?
Actually, Your Honor, the government's position is that each of those segments were reasonable. Like I stated previously, there was no point in time where the government stopped processing this case or began negligently or spitefully processing this case or foot-dragging. As a matter of fact, the defense argued that...
So should we or should we not be concerning ourselves with the forensic report?
The forensic report is very important in this case, Your Honor. So the fact that the government went to pre-preferral review, preferral, the Article 32 hearing, and referral, and then set a trial date without the actual report being completed is nothing but the government in a forward-leaning position trying to accommodate the petitioner's speedy trial rights in this case simply because a demand was made of speedy trial. And when a demand of speedy trial is made at the point in time that it was made in this case, it is putting the power in the hands of the accused in the sense that they can then control the amount of investigation the government has the ability to do. They can put a stop on the government's ability to collect evidence, do a proper investigation by hamstringing the government's time frame. And in this case, when you're talking about the forensic investigation required on the complex hard drive, the iMac hard drive, as well as the sheer volume of computer evidence, that's essentially what the defense did in this case, is they put a time limit on the government's ability to make their case.
But doesn't the Constitution, in this case Article 10, require that there be some time limit?
Actually, Article 10 does not provide a specific time limit, but it does
keep
require
it moving.
Reasonable diligence. And as a matter of fact, arraignment doesn't even stop the clock under Article 10 for reasonable diligence. And so the clock continues to run despite arraignment. And in this case, the government was reasonably diligent in all of their actions from the very beginning of putting him in pretrial confinement and attempting to get a pretrial confinement hearing quicker than the defense could be there for. The defense specifically brought up the period of time between preferral to the Article 32 being a problem for the defense. However, there's evidence in the record that Major King actually submitted her availability for the Article 32 back on the 17th of November. Prior to preferral, she stated she was not available for 32 until the 13th of December. So the amount of time between preferral and the Article 32 hearing is really irrelevant in this case because the defense wasn't able to go any sooner than 13th of December, and she made that clear long before preferral.
Counsel, is the government on the same page as the defense as far as the following? At some point, the prosecution's interest in perfecting its case and insulating itself against possible problems can transform itself into unreasonable delay.
Yes, Your Honor, the government would agree to that statement. However,
I understand you're not conceding it in this case. And my next question is, you were talking earlier about the question of whether the prosecution had sufficient evidence to proceed. What in the record would establish that the prosecution did not have sufficient evidence to proceed and that it needed to take the extra time in this case? That may or may not be the standard, but I didn't see that in the decision of the court below, that they were saying without this extra evidence, the government could not have proceeded.
Well, Your Honor, in making that statement, it's government's position that having a final report is critical information. When you're talking about computer crimes that they were discussing in this case, along with the violation of the no-contact order was based off of emails received under a different name. Now,
so what if the report had come back and said, these disks have all been wiped clean, we have nothing to report? Would the prosecution be unable to proceed in this case, or would it simply have a more difficult case?
Your Honor, the prosecution would certainly go forward on the case. They're not unable to proceed. However,
well, that's an important point, because that's different from, I understand the point of trigger, that's different from the point you were making before, where you said that the government needed this information to proceed. To be more precise, then, it's not the government's position, according to what you've said now, that they needed this information to proceed. Rather, it was information that they viewed as helpful.
Yes, Your Honor, I don't want to state to the court that without this final report, they would not have proceeded. That is not a correct statement. But the case law is clear that reasonable diligence does not require the government to go forward without properly investigating their case. And as a matter of fact, in this case, the military judge found in his findings of fact that the government did have a right to methodically and carefully prepare the case. However, he held the government to an impossible burden in this case, because he stated in his findings of fact as well that even if the court didn't consider the time frame between 5 January and 30 January, he would have still found a violation under Article 10. And that's, you know, bringing the trial clock back down to 84 days. And the forensic investigation was not even able to be completed at that point in time. So the judge in this case was holding the government to an impossible burden as far as processing the evidence and doing a proper and careful investigation.
What are the key points on which the defense in this case views a matter as a finding of fact and the government views it as a conclusion of law?
Well, Your Honor, as this court found in United States v. Burris, finding of fact is something that can be proven or shown in the record. It can be tested for clear error. As a matter of fact, a quote, in entering the finding of fact, the military judge must rely on evidence of record which fairly supports that finding. In the absence of any such evidence, the finding is error as a matter of law. Therefore, if there is something in the military judge's finding of fact that cannot be proven or shown in the record, it is not a finding of fact, but is an opinion or a conclusory statement that is speculative, as the Air Force Court found.
Well, I appreciate that, but my question was, what are the points? That is, where is something in this case where the defense is asserting that this is a critical finding of fact that we test for clearly erroneous, and the government says, no, that is not a finding of fact, that's an opinion or conclusion of law which is tested de novo. What specific items do you want us to look at and say that you're in disagreement with the defense as to whether that's a finding of fact?
Yes, Your Honor. One statement would be the military judge's finding that the pre-referral review took, quote unquote, too long. The fact that his statement of DCFL should have attached a high priority to their examination of the materials in this case, and potentially it could have been completed sooner.
But if the judge had said that DCFL did not attach a high priority, that would then be a conclusion of fact, or excuse me, a statement of fact?
Actually, Your Honor, the government does not believe that's a statement of fact, considering the testimony in the case was that this investigation was given a Category 1 priority.
I think what you're saying there is you disagree as to whether that is a correct statement of fact. But
yes,
if the judge said they did not attach a high priority to it, why wouldn't that be a conclusion, a statement of fact, that would be tested for under clearly erroneous standard?
If the record were to support that statement, it would be a finding of fact, yes, sir.
If the record didn't support it at all, why isn't it a finding of fact? it may be an erroneous finding of fact, but it's why would it not be a finding of fact? I'm trying to figure out what you're identifying here as findings of fact and what are you identifying as conclusions of law. You're suggesting, I believe, I want to put words in your mouth, that this is a finding of fact that's clearly erroneous as opposed to saying it's a conclusion of law.
Actually, Your Honor, what I'm trying to convey is that a finding of fact is defined as something that can be shown or proven in the record. If it cannot be shown or proven in the record, then it is not a finding of fact through the law. Am I not answering your question, sir?
I understand your answer, but before you said you were taking the position that something had to either be a finding of fact or a conclusion of law, and whether or not they gave something a high priority would always seem to be a finding of fact.
I'm having a hard time agreeing that it's always a finding of fact, that statement, because it would depend on the testimony provided in the hearing. However, if in this case the judge found that it was given a high priority, then that would be a finding of fact.
So that it took too long, whether they should have given it high priority, what else is erroneously labeled as a finding of fact when it should have been a conclusion of law? That's critical to this case.
When the judge found that case preparation would not be required, he made that statement various times. Comments about why something took so long to review with a question mark, that would be an opinion. That it was not a realistic hope to wait for the DCFL examination to be completed. The judge is discussing why it took so long to notify the defense of the appointment when he stated, I have trouble understanding why it took 9 days to notify the defense.
I'm only looking for those that you regard as critical in undermining the judge's decision from your perspective, not every particular item that you might not care for the phrasing.
Okay. I just want to make sure that I included the ones that the Air Force Court stated.
Well, we're familiar with the Air Force Court's decision, so we can rely on that unless there's anything further you want to add.
I believe I've already included those.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. Periods of inactivity in an otherwise active prosecution are not unreasonable or oppressive, and it's government's position that there was continued diligence and constant motion in this case. As far as prejudice to the appellant, the military judge found that the interests that Barker versus Wingo discusses as far as the three interests in testing prejudice to prevent oppressive incarceration, minimize anxiety and concern of the accused, and limit the possibility the defense will be impaired did not apply in this case. The anxiety and concern did not exceed the norm, and there was no showing that the defense was impaired. Therefore, there was no prejudice to the appellant in this case by the judge's finding of fact. Again, the government showed reasonable diligence in moving this case along.
Now, why is the finding on prejudice a finding of fact and not a conclusion of law?
Your Honor, I didn't mean to imply that it was a conclusion of law. I simply meant to, or I'm sorry, it is a conclusion of law.
Okay.
I was just discussing.
Seems to me you were jumping back on the other side of the fence.
Discussing what the military judge stated in his finding of fact. In conclusion, the Air Force Court applied the proper standard and found the government acted in reasonable diligence. When applying the four Barker factors, in this case, it is clear the petitioner was not denied a right to a speedy trial. Accordingly, the government asks this court to affirm the Air Force Court's holding. If there are no further questions.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, those statements that the government attorney pointed out should have given it a higher priority. It took too long. Case preparation would have been required. Findings of fact, conclusions of law. What are they?
Our position is that they're findings of fact. Additionally,
now, why is that? I mean, this is not something that can be found in the record. This is the judge applying his experience to the facts as he's found them. Isn't he making some type of an analytical process here?
Your Honor, there's always an analytical process involved when you're going from evidence, the testimony, the paperwork, whatever, to get to a finding of fact stage. Findings of facts necessarily, or making a finding of fact necessarily involves some level of judgment. So that doesn't necessarily preclude something from being a finding of fact. In response to the government's talk about the pretrial confinement and how it was no prejudice, We submit here that the reading of Barker v. Wingo is somewhat misplaced. Because in Barker v. Wingo, in that paragraph where they talk about what the interests were, we submit that the Supreme Court was not trying to come out and say that it's a speedy trial violation or it's a worse speedy trial violation because someone's confinement involves moldy bread and lukewarm water as opposed to being treated properly. What they were trying to do there was to say that to find prejudice in a speedy trial case, it's not a matter of saying, well, there's no prejudice because he was going to plead guilty anyway or because he was going to lose on the merits, that the prejudice is of an entirely different nature. And it's a recognition that it's unfair to, although we didn't have that in this case, it's unfair to burden someone's trial preparation. It's wrong to, or that the process creates anxiety and concern, and that most of all, that it is oppressive to warehouse human beings for 4 months while we're waiting for the government to get its collective act together.
Is it your position that the military judge found Barker prejudice here?
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
Just, I mean, even though he didn't find any of the three sub-factors for prejudice, he came out and said there's no prejudice other than the fact that he's been in pretrial confinement. That's enough?
Yes, Your Honor, that is enough. I'll also point out that when appellant's case is viewed in tandem with another case that shows up several times in the record, that's U.S. v. Berets, a case tried by the same legal office during the same time frame, you have a clear picture emerging, and that's the picture of an overreaching prosecution. The framers of the Constitution and the drafters of the UCMJ provided checks against this sort of manifestation of government power. And in Berets' court-martial, you saw one set of checks. You saw the jury trial, and you saw the need to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. And when the case got out before a jury of his peers, the members said, no, government, you don't have the evidence to prove all of those charges. You can have a conviction on one of eight, but not on all of them. Appellant's case reflects another check, the guarantees in the Sixth Amendment and in Article 10 of a speedy trial. And here, a military judge stood up and said, no, government, you can't just warehouse someone in confinement for 4 months while you're trying to see what all you can charge against him. And enforcing these rights sometimes means, as was the case in Berets and as was the case at trial here, that the government is going to lose when they come out in the field of play. I mean, a lot of times the rights will work to deter government overreach, but sometimes the jury or the judge just has to come out and say, no, government, you can't do that. And that's what the judge did here. And we're here today because the judge disagreed with that conclusion. But we're asking this court to exercise its duty of ensuring the rights of our service members by stepping in here and setting aside the Court of Criminal Appeals ruling and dismissing the charges and specifications. Are there any further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And we thank counsel for both parties for the presentation today. That case is now submitted, and that concludes our arguments for this morning. We'll recess until 9 a.m. tomorrow morning.